at npr.org.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
My guest today is one of my colleagues, Professor Dan Schiller from the University of Illinois, the Institute of Communications Research, and the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences. Dan Schiller's interest and research has been on the history and political economy of communication. He's written several books, five by latest count, down here, including most recently Digital Capitalism, Networking the Global Market System, and Theorizing Communication, A Historical Reckoning. Dan Schiller, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Do you have another book coming out pretty soon?
I wish sooner, but I'm working on a history of telecommunications.
The whole thing?
Well, from the 1880s forward, probably.
Well, that's U.S. telecommunications.
U.S. telecommunications, yes.
Terrific. A couple years away, you think, from the goal line?
Probably, depending on, imponderables.
Okay, well, wonderful. And this is an area that I think it's safe to say the history of telecommunications and really policymaking about communication that, if not the leading expert, certainly in the first tier of experts in the United States and, indeed, globally, as your reputation goes all over the world. Dan, what I'd like to talk about today with you on Media Matters, I'd like to talk about the current situation of media and communication, the big issues that face the United States and the world, and then put them in historical context so people get a sense of what the traditions are in the United States historically to address these issues, what we can learn from the past, what's there. But, you know, today, of course, the big story is the Internet. That is, for years now, has been the, you know, two-tongued gorilla of communication in the United States and the world. And the idea that the Internet's going to really radically transform the entire communication experience, not just media, not simply what we consider radio and television and newspapers, but even interpersonal communication or one-to-one communication that we traditionally associate with telephones, for example. And a lot of people see the Internet as this magical technology that just sort of does this wonderful sort of great stuff, and all we have to do is sit back and relax and let it work its magic. What's your sense of the Internet? How do you see it? What context? How do you think it's best to think of the Internet?
Well, I think the Internet is the most recent and in some respects the most impressive and even really extraordinary example of yet another telecommunications technology which is brought into conformity, you might say, with political economic structures and purposes, with social purposes, through political economic mechanisms of resources, funding, and policy constraints. And far from constituting a domain that is in some way not going to be governed or that will simply transform everything without reference to what it's been before, I think the Internet is perhaps the principal example we have in the current moment in communications of a phenomenon of being tamed, phenomenon of being brought into the governing structures of control in the communications industry, so that instead of, for example, mainly serving the purposes of interpersonal communication that you mentioned or information transfer and availability, the Internet is, for most people, increasingly just another commercial medium.
So, I mean, you were talking about political economic structures. I suspect a lot of our listeners haven't had the privilege of taking one of our seminars, might not be familiar with that term. In other words, the Internet's not like a magical technology that sort of landed on Earth from outer space and sort of changed everything, but was actually created by explicit policies. Is that another way to put it?
The Internet, to be sure, shows a convoluted and, in some respects, an unpredicted history. But if one reads back, as historians must, into that process, the Internet was created by very, very well-anchored and established institutions, notably the U.S. military, some leading universities, a few private contractors and computer companies were the institutional basis for what eventually 15, 20 years after their efforts were initiated, began to be known as the Internet, a network of networks that connected computer systems across not only the country but increasingly the world. But issues, just to take one example of political economic processes, that jargon that I used a little bit ago, issues of interconnection. How are networks actually interconnected? What is it that allows one computer network and its users to have access to the users and resources of another computer network? Well, this is not just a technical question. question. It's also a matter of policy. It's a matter of institutional arrangements between whoever runs those two different networks. And this is an area where there has very definitely been an intrusion, if you want to call it, that by established political economic interests and entities. On what terms will interconnection occur? Who's going to pay whom?
Yeah. Now, one of the core policies that the Internet was based on for a long time was the notion of open access, that anyone could use the phone wires, basically, to equally. There weren't prejudice against anyone, sort of like the tradition coming out of regulation of the telephone system. And so, you know, anyone could have access to the Internet via their phone wires. Someone could put up a website. And it was pretty much an open system. And a lot of people have assumed, well, that's just the nature of the Internet. By definition, is always open. No one can regulate it. But in fact, it was an explicit regulation that mandated that it be open to all at the same charge. And is that, if I understand what you were just saying now, that necessarily isn't going to be the case in the future?
Well, these need to be looked at as fiercely contested issues. This one has been pretty fiercely contested for several years now, not across the full range of interconnection issues, but in terms of the different kinds of network access conditions that are made available by cable television companies on the one side and local telephone companies on the other. And the rules that govern such matters are different if you're a cable television system seeking to offer through a cable modem internet access, or on the other hand, a telephone company using a technology called DSL, digital subscriber line, to offer internet access. The telephone companies, or the telephone side of the industry, you might say, has historically been placed under much, much more stringent regulations that make necessary a degree of open access that has not been true and is increasingly untrue of the cable television side. And there's every reason to think that as we move into an era of mobile internet access, for example, these same issues will be revisited.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We taped this show a few days before going on air so both of us could get away for a Thanksgiving holiday with our families. So don't call in today. Just sit back, make a cup of tea, relax, enjoy, listen to the show. We're talking about the Internet and media policy today, but also we're going to be looking at it historically. Dan Schiller is arguably the leading political economist and historian of telecommunication policy in the United States. And Dan, before we go into the history, let's talk a little about the term telecommunication, because we often talk about media on this show. In fact, that's the title of the show, Media Matters, and it's certainly the area of my own work. Telecommunication, what is that? How does that relate to media?
Well, you're asking a very profound question here.
Oh, of course.
Well,
what else
would
we expect on Media Matters?
Right. Well, the point, though, is that telecommunications, in its strict meaning, simply suggests communications at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
The term telecommunications, for that reason, is capable of being stretched over, for example, broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
It's capable of being stretched over what the post office does. Both of those fall under the term. Typically, it has tended to be restricted in usage to mean point-to-point communications, some part of which would be the sort of interpersonal but mediated communication that you referred to when you talk about the telephone system. So
mm-hmm.
the telephone system, telegraph system, computer networks, these are in the core definition of telecommunications.
Mm-hmm.
There's one further point that I'd want to insist on as vital, which is that the telecommunications system, far from being an opaque and remote domain that has no relevance to that more familiar part of communications that we think of as media, intertwines with the media system all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vital, vital connected point, or connecting system, I should say, for the distribution of media images, of media messages of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And exploring the nature of these relationships is something to which I think we need to give more attention.
You know, when I was going to grad school, or maybe even as an undergrad, and I was studying media and communications, I remember a professor once saying that telecommunication referred to what distinguished telecommunication from that gave it a distinct category, because it didn't distinguish it from anything else necessarily, was that telecommunication referred to when communication could travel faster than people. That was the distinct
mm-hmm.
nature, meaning that the great revolution in communication was when you had the telegraph, which was the first time you could send communication fast and a person could travel physically. Mm-hmm. And that, this is what the revolution was of the telegraph. And that's really what it's been all about since then, is this ability to shorten time and space radically, much faster than human beings can move their molecules or atoms through space. And in that sense, then, the distinction was that prior to this type of telecommunication, the telegraph, that really when you talked about communication, it was interchangeable with transportation, because ideas, thoughts could only move as quickly as a person's butt could be moved around. And therefore, something like the stagecoach was both a transportation and communication medium. And you have something like the post office, which was indeed both transportation and communication. They were
absolutely
interchangeable.
And the post office provided and laid down institutional foundations for subsequent telecommunications technologies that have been absolutely critical.
Yeah, to our listeners, I must confess, you're probably listening to two of the biggest post office junkies in the world are about to get off on this now, because as a historian, I just recently, for my own research, have studied the post office, and I don't think I ever quite appreciated the significant role it played in American history, especially in the first century, and in particular in the first few generations prior to the telegraph, when it was the main communication medium in the United States. And you've taught this for years. You've written about it. I mean, it's an area that you've really studied as much as anyone I know. And I think for our listeners' sake, I mean, because today, we think about the post office and you think about, goofy people on sitcoms like Cliff Clavin or something, and it's sort of a source of humor, if anything. And it's really lost, I think, its foundational role in American history. And the role, as you just said, that laid traditions that are very important to this day for how we view the setup of communication systems. So talk a little bit about the formation of the post office, what its role was, what the vision was for it.
Well, I'm going to start by adding something to what you said just now, which is it's not only that the post office is an object of derision and ridicule or incompetence, but that in phrases like going postal, we have a connotation that goes beyond that into some sort of act of malice.
Mm-hmm.
The post office is part of the problem, whatever it is. And in fact, of course, for 30 years now, it's been the Postal Service, not the post office, as it followed a process of reorganization that brought it somewhat out of the direct domain of the government, although it's still very much lodged there. Going to the early American Republic, the post office was the only game in town if you're talking about long-distance message transmission, and it helped to underwrite the formation of a national transportation grid, post roads, stagecoaches, eventually railroads, and in fact, in the 20th century, air travel all had subsidies from the post office, meaning from you and me, one way or another.
Where did the post office come from? I mean, what's the authorization for the post office? Why do we have a post office?
The post office is basically part of the constitutional provision for the American Republic, and it borrowed from British precedent.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Constitution and then in the Post Office Act of 1792, modifying and greatly expanding on the constitutional provisions, there is an affirmative commitment made to expanding postal service, to making sure that the post office should never be used for purposes of political surveillance or any other kind of surveillance by the government, and to rapidly providing service to the interior of the country, and doing so on terms that bring postal routes not only to individual users, but also to those who make available a critical staple for any kind of democratic republic, no matter how incompletely realized, namely news.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were special subsidies. It's not even fair to call them subsidies. Low rates were established pretty much by direct congressional intent, going back to 1792.
Well, I think you can say, from my own research, I think we can eliminate the words pretty much. I think we can say absolutely,
fair
quite
enough.
Conscious, direct congressional intent.
Fair enough, because the theory was, and for some of us remains, that it's essential for the citizenry to have access to the most rich-blooded stream of reporting, of journalism, of news, of information across the whole gamut of things that news and information must cover in order to exercise their rights as citizens of the
Now, in the early republic, Dan Schiller, did they have a lot of junk mail? I mean, what percentage of the mail was newspapers or periodicals?
It depends how you count, but if you count by volume, probably upwards of 90%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, this was largely a communication medium. I mean, this was like the distribution arm of our entire press system.
Absolutely. And newspapers set up a specialized system for exchanging news reports between one another, again, at very favorable rates, so that even in an era that didn't have access to any electric telecommunications system, it was possible for a town or a remote rural editor to have access to news accounts from New York, from Washington, from any other centers of commerce and politics, and to reprint the most topical and important stories and to fashion them again for a local audience.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today. My guest is Dan Schiller, a professor at the University of Illinois, expert on telecommunication and media history and political economy. We're talking about the core issues of media policy today, the internet, and putting it in historical context, discussing the traditions in American history that govern and regulate media and telecommunication systems. And right now we're talking about the post office. This is a pre-recorded show, so sit back, listen, enjoy yourself, and let Dan and me do the talking. Now, Dan, today we hear politicians constantly talking about government services in a derisive manner, that these are services that should be turned to the private sector, that they should be run by commercial values, they should not be run by the government. Virtually anything the government does that can be privatized is subject to that argument, which is virtually everything. And, you know, and oftentimes the founders are invoked in these debates. This is the American way, that we have everything in private hands, and if money can be made, that's the way Jefferson and Madison and God and everyone back then, all the good people, wanted. Yet the post office, as I understand it, was in fact explicitly a government-run institution. Was there a lot of pressure in the early republic to have this made part of the private sector with the great commitment our founders had for having commercial values run everything?
No, although I will tell you that in the 1840s, for a period of perhaps a decade, there was a debate over the idea of privatizing the post office.
Mm-hmm.
What's significant
that
about
that was 50 years after. So we went a couple generations where that was never broached.
Yes, but what's significant about that debate is that when it came, it broached every issue that is discussed in any more contemporary discussion of things. Can't the government, can't the private sector do it more adequately? Is it more efficient? Is it a governmental responsibility to provide postal service? Is it not something that's lucrative for whoever gets there first? All of these issues were raised. But what's most definitively important about that 1840s debate is the way it was resolved. And it was resoundingly resolved that the postal monopoly should be not only allowed, but consolidated and given further legislative mandate. And that's exactly what happened. And it's on that basis going forward from the 1840s into the 1850s, and particularly after the Civil War, that the post office built out an infrastructure that very soon touched the lives of virtually every American directly.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, the 1840s, is the reason this debate came up was because of the emergence of the telegraph? Did that have anything to do with it? Because that was right around the same time the telegraph was coming, wasn't
it?
Yes,
there was a connection between the two discussions, but it was not in any simple sense the cause of it. In fact, it went the other way. Many of the early telegraph speculators and promoters, early telegraph capitalists, got their start in the post office and also in the private competitors that sprung up around the post office to deliver specialized services to business users.
Yeah, I don't think today it's very easy to appreciate what a revolution the telegraph was at the time it came about, because as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it is the first moment realistically that information and ideas could move faster than people. And you know, that's an extraordinary development if you think about it. How long did it, you know, to take a train, or not a train, trains didn't exist, take a horse ride from New York to Washington or Boston to Washington prior to the railroads, prior to the telegraph. It would have been many days, wouldn't it?
Well, you're talking days and hours for the fastest routes, I suppose, compared to minutes.
When the telegraph.
For the telegraph. And the only reason it's minutes is because of the, by our standards, primitive character of the technology in that very early era. But people at the time greeted the telegraph with almost a mystical reverence.
I mean, it makes the internet probably look like child's play, because we've been conditioned by all sorts of other stuff long before the internet.
Well, it's not by accident that one book that's written on this subject is titled The Victorian Internet, mm-hmm. about the telegraph, because it had that same kind of quality of being almost beyond comprehension, wondrous to the point of being heaven sent.
Now, when the telegraph came along, though, it was not run by the government. It was a private sector operation. Was this the fact that the technology came along later, so America had changed by the 1830s and 40s and 50s, or it was something about the technology itself? I mean, why was not the telegraph instantly regarded like the post office as something that the government would run as some sort of natural monopoly?
That's another good question. I think
I'm full of them today.
Well, you're batting 100 here, 1,000,
whatever
it is.
What a sports fan
I'm in the wrong sports
yeah,
side.
Okay, go ahead, Dan.
At any rate, the telegraph system was still a very fledgling operation, of course, when it got started in the mid-1840s. And what's interesting there is that, in fact, the very earliest telegraph system, that which followed the plan of Samuel Morse, its U.S. inventor, was an operation of the United States government. It was a government operation.
Oh, really?
And it was denationalized in 1844, 1845.
Was it a big fight over that at the time?
There was a fight over the time, and in fact, it was probably the case that majority opinion was that it should remain in governmental hands, including many prominent newspaper editors and politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the strength of the entrepreneurial instinct in the 1840s bears comparison to what we've seen, say, in the roaring 1990s,
mm-hmm.
To use Joseph Stiglitz's mm-hmm. recent description of it. And so it was a very, it was an uphill fight to keep that system in government hands. At the same time, the fact that it was still not anything like a nationwide system, it was just originally a route between Baltimore and Washington, meant that the government would have to argue that it would have the resources to extend the system, that it could do so rapidly, and at that time the private entrepreneurs made arguments just like they make in the internet context, say, well, we can do it faster, we can do it better, and just let us have it because we're here right now and want to do it. And that's in fact what did occur. And the result was a kind of 20 years of chaos in telegraph system building, the main positive benefit of which was that you got a national telegraph grid. But more properly, what you got was rival telegraph grids operating over different parts of the United States.
And what was the problem with having – isn't competition supposed to be good? I mean – what's the problem with having these rival grids?
This is a complex question, but just one part of the answer is that companies or individuals that were getting started building these systems were more concerned to put a good face on where they were going than on where they'd been. So the telegraph networks were often quite literally falling apart behind the network builders as they moved from town to town. They get to a new town, say, let's try to get some money together to build the system out to the next town, St. Louis to, you know, Omaha or whatever it's going to be, and meanwhile, the link from Memphis to St. Louis is literally falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no disciplined system building here. There was just an earlier historian called an era of methodless enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. And what was the upshot? So this is from the 1840s and 1850s. You had a number of different entrepreneurs and businesses competing to set up a telegraph system.
Using rival patent approaches as well.
So they were not compatible technologically?
Some of them were not compatible with one another. And this, in the greater sweep of history, this rapidly was supplanted by an integrated system some 20, 25 years later, by the late 1860s.
And by then, so this is following the Civil War, now we're really in the heyday of the telegraph, the second half of the 19th century.
Yes, we are.
I mean, you've got a national system. It's widespread. It's a part of everyday life for the economy and for the politics. What was the telegraph system like now by 1869, 1870?
The telegraph system was one of the first two truly nationwide corporate monopolies in the United States, the other being the Associated Press, which is a little different because it's a
cooperative. We'll get to that in a second, but this is Western Union.
Western Union. And as such, it was, in a way, viewed by contemporaries across a very broad reach of business and society, not only reformers by any means, but business people, politicians, senators, representatives, postmasters general, of course, for somewhat opportunistic reasons in that case. But it was viewed by a very wide range of Americans as a shark, a predator capable of bringing down anybody on the landscape, and it lived up to that reputation.
So there's basically one telegraph company. If I live in Cleveland and I wanted to sell a telegraph to my friend in Columbus or a business in Cincinnati or Detroit, I don't have two or three places to go. I either go to Western Union or it doesn't get sent.
Yeah, by the 1880s, there's a successful effort to kind of claim a niche market in telegraphy besides Western Union and in its shadow. But the Western Union system is the telegraph system in the United States for all practical purposes. And it was not above, historians seem to have detected through their research, looking into other people's messages. It certainly was not above introducing an incredibly convoluted rate structure and
a monopoly rate structure
that basically extorted its users on behalf of its own feather bedding instincts.
And I assume that the shareholders in Western Union made a nice return on their investment.
Shareholders made a very, very good return, and the shareholders included the roster of robber barons whose names are familiar to us coming down through the decades. Oh, yeah, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jay Gould. Jay Gould, do you want to hear a story about
this? I sure do.
Jay Gould decided he would try to profit from the animosity that existed to the telegraph monopoly around Western Union.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I'm going to build my own telegraph system to compete with it. What he had going for him in that prospect was a very extended system of railroads with the rights of way along the tracks that railroads made possible. So people took this seriously, including Wall Street. He drove down the price of Western Union by this tactic to the point that he could then acquire the largest share of the largest block of shares in Western Union, and eventually through process that lasted a couple of years, made himself the controlling interest in the company and took it over. Then continued to do much more than Western Union had ever done before that in the same roster of tactics that had already been developed as a monopoly telegraph operator. Rates went up, service levels went down, and something we haven't talked about yet, wages went down for the employees working in the telegraph industry. He was widely reviled by, meaning hated, by the American population for his role in this little coup.
So you've got Jay Gould, one of the most famous or infamous of the robber barons of the Gilded Age, being the majority shareholder, the dominant force behind Western Union, one of the largest companies in the country, I assume, if not the largest, certainly in the short list of the largest firms of the era, with the monopoly control over the main electronic telecommunication system, the telegraph. And having this private monopoly that's largely unregulated, I assume, and it's generating a great deal of animosity on a number of fronts due to its monopoly power, its treatment of workers. I assume, as in most monopoly communication services, lousy service in many respects. What sort of political reaction was there in the late 19th century to this?
There were about 45 bills introduced into Congress over the late 19th century to postalize the telegraph system.
Mm-hmm.
That's one.
To nationalize it or make it a government?
To bring it into the post office, which, just because it's not well understood in the United States today, was actually the growing practice among the trading partners of the United States. So in Britain, you saw the telegraph brought into the post office monopoly beginning in the 1860s. Eventually Germany, France, they had already gone down this road. Japan, Canada would try eventually to do this, although there it ran the risk, or actually the ran against the problem that much of its network was controlled by the United States interests.
Mm-hmm. But the pattern worldwide basically was to have the telegraph be part of the post office, a publicly owned monopoly.
Yes, it was. And that was the best practice model that the United States could look to when it, the United States itself, was just an aspiring power rather than an unquestioned trendsetter around the globe.
And what happened to these 45 legislative bills?
They were all defeated. There was tremendous...
So now we're betting zero.
from 1,000 to 0,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Western Union monopoly helped to innovate various kinds of lobbying techniques and arm twisting that run the gamut of the same forms that are visible today in state houses and federal government activities.
How big of an issue was this in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s? I mean, was this like high on the list of progressive or populist reformers, or was it just, you know, number 72 on the list of 75 things they worried about?
Well, people will disagree about this, but in my view, and I've looked into it over a period of years, it was a very significant issue. There were many people concerned about it, and what's interesting is the degree to which this reform campaign has been buried from historical memory.
Mm-hmm.
It existed. It was alive. It drew in hundreds of thousands of people. When the Knights of Labor, which was the first industrial trade union federation in the United States, was at its high point in the 1880s, they had, I don't know what the figure is, but probably at least many hundreds of thousands, maybe even over 1 million members. And the Knights of Labor helped to get started a petition drive to postalize the telegraph system in the 1880s that in 3 weeks got, I think it's 700,000 signatures.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Now, there's another part of the history of the telegraph in this period that's very important for media, which is the relationship with newspapers, which also isn't well known, but it's absolutely central to understanding crucial developments that affect us to this day with what we call our journalism and our media system. Talk about that, if you would, Dan.
Well, I want to preface this by reiterating something I said before. This is a very, very good example of one of the links between the telecommunications system and the media system.
Mm-hmm.
The telecommunications system and the media system, in fact, are one system.
Yeah.
Not, they're two pieces of one system, not separate entities.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, this is a good illustration of that point, because what you find is that the masters of the telegraph were in a very strong position to influence and structure even the character of the news. And one way they did that was through the operations of an entity we haven't talked about much, the Associated Press. The Associated Press was ostensibly a cooperative of newspapers, or based on newspapers, who agreed, because it was cheaper to do it this way, to exchange news accounts with one another,
mm-hmm,
across the territory of the continental United States.
So if you had a paper in New York and you wanted a story based in Texas, you wouldn't have to send a reporter there, theoretically. Someone, a Texas newspaper, would cover it and then send it to you, and you could use that account.
Exactly, and vice versa.
And vice versa.
So this was a very effective and even a necessary improvement in the news-gathering system, and yet it was not simply a cooperative with all of the mutualism and seeming sort of social reformism that implies. It was actually a kind of an ideologically controlled operation, and part of that control came from the interlock between the Associated Press and Western Union.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, to make a long story short, the two organizations agreed that they would only do business with one another in exclusive contracts.
Mm-hmm.
This meant that Western Union's largest source of revenue, the news business, the Associated Press, would agree not to help subvene a rival, any would-be rival telegraph company.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, Associated Press gained favorable access to Western Union lines. So they had a kind of a quid pro quo there. But what it also meant, this quid pro quo, this tight interlocking of people at the very apex of economic power in the United States, it meant that they could together work on various issues to try to crowd out viewpoints that might actually have been genuinely popular, might have been very much in the interest of ordinary people to have access to, but which were simply, from the point of view of these rulers of the wires, anathema. They were off limits. They were not things that people of property and standing would want to condone. And what I have in mind here are things like labor news.
Yeah.
Labor news was suppressed in a very extensive way in the time of the telegraph industry's unregulated prime in the late 19th century.
And there's a number of ways this relationship worked out of tremendous importance. On one hand, all newspapers were desperate to be part of the Associated Press to some extent because it gave you access to all national news. But that was the only game in town since Western Union wouldn't let any other system start up. So newspapers that weren't part of the AP system found themselves at an extraordinary competitive disadvantage in their community if they were going up against papers with the AP. So it was a monopolizing effect in local markets. It gave tremendous advantages, made it impossible for the other papers to compete.
So absolutely.
It had to spur concentrated media ownership in every town.
Absolutely, and it also worked towards, as I said, ideological discipline from to support the interests of the rulers of the system.
And I think specifically, in other words, this is important, and it has tremendous pertinence for the issues we've been talking about in this program for the past 2 years, media policies in Washington. I wonder how those Associated Press papers covered all the debates over whether to postalize the Western Union. Is there any pattern that you could detect?
Well, this is an area where if there's some enterprising doctoral student out there or would-be doctoral student, we'd love to get that person to work on it. But there are some very, very interesting indications. There's no question that there was a greater range of discussion accorded to postalization than we would get in today's landscape, in the late 19th century.
And it was covered in the news.
There is some coverage, but there are also some almost smoking guns in the documentary sources where I've seen some indications that a particular well-placed editor writes to the head of Western Union and says, I'm glad I was able to be of service to you on the debate over postalization. Next time it's your turn to do me a favor.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Dan Schiller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a couple days before Thanksgiving, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax and enjoy the remaining 20 minutes of the show or so. We've been talking about telecommunication and media history, the crucial policy debates that give us the system for regulation and ownership that we have today, trying to help us understand the great fights over media policies that have been taking place in Washington and nationally over the past couple of years and that look to be almost certain to accelerate in the coming years, given the importance of the Internet and other media systems in our culture. Now, Dan, let's go chronologically if we can. Now let's turn to what I think is the area you've studied the most, which is the telephone system, which is really the next great revolution in telecommunications. When did that come along, and how does that fit into, how did that relate to the telegraph, and what regulatory system emerged with the telephone, and why is it important?
Well, that's a lot to answer there, Bob. I'll do my best here. The telephone system, of course, as everybody knows, was invented, or at least the telephone instrument was invented in 1876 by Alexander Graham Bell. It took some time for it to find widespread application. 2% of American households probably had telephone access directly in 1894. That's a significant date because that is the termination point for the initial Bell patents, which gave it one significant point of purchase toward monopoly power in the industry, and one that it very vigorously exploited to prevent all would-be competitors from staying out of the industry. The result was that it enjoyed super profits during the first 17 years of its existence, and only 2% of American households had access to the telephone. That then triggered a view quite understandable amongst probably the dominant proportion of Americans that the telephone was likely to become, or even just to remain, a system that followed in the track of the telegraph. The telegraph never achieved more than 5% penetration in terms of regular use by Americans. In other words, decades down from its invention, the telegraph was used by 5% of the American population. In 1894...
Largely, I assume, with the upper income echelon.
Absolutely. Businesses and upper echelon. For ordinary people, the only time you ever got a telegram was to announce a death in the family. Mm. And that's one of the reasons that people greeted a Western Union messenger at the door with fear. And that's down through the 1940s and 50s.
Yeah. Yeah.
At any rate, the telephone gave every sign of following this same dismal path, and this provoked a significant reform effort in its own right around the turn of the 20th century, where many, many hundreds of thousands of people were motivated to come together around a concern that the telephone system should not be allowed to be undeveloped and controlled by a monopolist in the fashion that Western Union had been. This was given a sharp point when Bell, which prodded by newly competitive independent telephone operations in the period after the patents expired, turned around and bought a controlling interest in Western Union. Bell bought out the Gould stake in Western Union and then tried on the grounds of so-called economic efficiency to bring the two systems together and to turn it into a single integrated monopoly. This infuriated both.
Because one of the T's in AT&T is for telegraph?
Absolutely. Yeah. AT&T had two T's, and that's from 1885 forward.
Okay.
It showed that inclination when it took the majority or the controlling stake in Western Union. The result was to fire people, meaning to inspire people to insist that this system had to be accorded some sort of more effective regulatory oversight. And it's fair to say that from the 1900s to the 1930s and 40s, this was the abiding goal of reformers of a variety of different kinds. The problem was that they were relatively successful in pushing through state regulation. And so state public utility commissions date early in this era.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that the state public utility commissions were by and large powerless to do an effective job of, even if they did have a will to do so, in regulating what was, after all, an increasingly integrated national telephone network. You needed to have a federal regulatory presence, not only a presence, but an assertive interventionist agency to accomplish this. And it was only during the New Deal and even the 1940s that this actually transpired.
Yeah, and this took place with the passage of the 1934 Communications Act, which set up the formal federal regulation of telephony, if I understand. And so we had a monopoly system, much like in telegraph, but held under some sort of public accountability. Is that the difference?
Yes, and the thing that's so fascinating about this is that the telephone monopoly, which had prior to this been such a source of unrestrained private power, became a source of control for regulators by virtue of its monopoly structure. It became possible to exercise end-to-end control of the telephone system using the AT&T monopoly.
So it actually had positive benefits then, the system as it emerged.
One could overstate them. I mean, the system continued. It's not a golden age in which everything followed the path of the good, the true, and the beautiful. Far from it. But by comparison to either what came before or what came later, it has much to commend it.
Now, the crucial concessions that AT&T made that Western Union didn't have to make, because it was granted this national monopoly, but it was also regulated, it had to make concessions in terms of its pricing. It had to get its prices approved. Is that right?
Yes. The regulators have the right and, in fact, the obligation to examine the tariffs that the telephone company files for each service that it seeks to introduce or to retain. And the regulators get to inquire into the data that the telephone company is using to back up those prices. The most significant dimension of change in the pricing patterns of the telephone system were that local service began to be priced at a lower rate, and long-distance service was asked to pay more of its own way. Prior to the 1940s, long-distance service had been getting a free ride off of local ratepayers, and local ratepayers were not happy about this. And it's important to say not only local ratepayers, but those who sought to be local ratepayers but who couldn't even get access to the telephone system, because only 40% of the households of this country had the telephone in 1940.
And this has important sort of social or economic class dimensions, because subsidizing long-distance services, subsidizing business users to a significant extent, and local users are the people who like to use the phones but couldn't afford them in their home.
And it's important, Bob, to remember that we're not just talking about frivolity here. We're not just talking about, oh, let's go have a conversation that doesn't matter if it happens or not. Telephone is an instrument of life and death. It's an instrument for people who are shut-ins, sick, having accidents, as well as for more prosaic uses like trying to figure out when to get a plumber or whatnot. I mean, it is a functional tool as well as a means of sociability and conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're intertwined, and it's hard to say when one begins and the other ends. Who's to say that someone who is trying to provide reassurance or condolence to a remote relative over the telephone system isn't performing an indispensable cultural function?
So the system was in place for decades, but then starting, or not necessarily starting, but culminating by the 70s and 80s and certainly the 1990s, tremendous pressure to break up, and eventually would break up, the AT&T system in the early 1980s. leading to the formation of the seven baby bells and splitting off the long-distance service. Was that a good thing? I mean, more competition, more companies? What's your sense of that?
I see a divergence here. I think that competition in telecommunications, although it's undoubtedly inspired a great deal of technical innovation, is also a culprit in very, very fundamental ways, because competition has been used as a way of subverting the public service responsibilities of the system. And those were substantial. I'll just give you one among many possible examples.
Okay.
The wireless system that is now the gung-ho area of telecommunications system development, along with data, wireless are the two bright spots in
the
system.
You mean like cell phones?
Cell phones, mobile applications, yeah.
Wi-Fi.
Wireless telephony is, as every user knows, which means an increasing fraction of the U.S. population, a technically inferior system. It's a system where you're used to having calls be dropped, static on the line, inferior quality of access. This is not something that's foreordained. It's built in. It's built in because they can get away with it. They can get away with it because the new regime, if you want to call it that, in telecommunications service provision has abdicated public service responsibility.
I mean, we could have good cell phone calls that
absolutely aren't fuzzy. And in fact, statistical studies show that there is a differential between the wireline system, which was engineered to deliver, I think, 99.998 reliable results, and the wireless system, which is at an inferior standard.
So you're not a big fan of competition in telecommunications, then, in other words.
I think competition is a red herring. It's like apple pie. Everybody wants to be for competition because you think it's supposedly a good thing. In the case of telecommunications, the issue is what has happened to public service principle? What has happened to the responsibilities of oversight that used to exist? There's no reason that they cannot be imposed on a competitive industry. But in fact, the use of a competitive industry is mainly as a wedge against the continuation of that kind of public service responsibility. One further very critical instance of that,
okay.
The employment area. We've lost hundreds of thousands of jobs in telecommunications in the last 3 years, hundreds of thousands, and every indication is there'll be more to come. How could that happen? Should that be allowed to happen? In the period of the New Deal, with the new settlement that was arranged, there was a very significant concern, not anywhere near an ideal one, but a much more significant concern by regulators for employment, for the number of workers, and for the character of the jobs and the payment for the jobs that they received. This is now basically absent. And so you have a situation where a supposedly core industry of the information economy is in free fall in terms of employment. Jobs outsourced to India, jobs non-existent or going, day to day and week to week.
Well, Dan Schiller, I'm a little confused, though. I've been taught and instructed by our politicians that increasing competition in industry means that the firms will have to be more responsive to customers, so the quality of service goes up because there's competitive threat to lose business, and that there be therefore probably lower prices and higher quality. You're saying that hasn't resulted from increasing competition in telecommunications?
Well, of course, the picture is a very complex picture. But if you look, going back to the key issue that you raised a few minutes ago, which is local service as opposed to long distance, local rates have stayed stationary at best. And in terms of what people pay out of pocket, they're pretty much the same as they were 20 years ago. For long-distance service, you can have access to around the world now on an ever cheaper basis, and that has introduced all kinds of new possibilities. But ordinary people who use long-distance less proportionately than well-off people or business users are paying more for that privilege. So on that one index, yes, competition's not been a good thing.
So you'd be a proponent of returning to a more rigorous regulation of telecommunications similar to the New Deal era?
Well, again, you're introducing a lot of things all at once. There's
okay.
No question that telecommunications has been, since the 1930s, and will be going forward, as far as the eye can see, a regulated industry. There is no likelihood at all, zero, that this is going to see deregulation despite any rhetoric. This is because there are such fights between the different competitive entities in the telecommunications industry. Local Bell companies versus more recent competitive local exchange carriers versus wireless carriers versus cable television companies entering the market versus whatever. So the fights have provoked a fierce concern to preserve a regulatory agency so as to sort things out, if possible, in the interest of one or the other of these entities. What has been abandoned is not regulation, but public service.
Regulation in the public interest.
Regulation in some explicit fashion that is consecrated to an identifiable public interest. That's what's gone.
Now, if you were able to put together a platform for a political party or politicians and the sort of the key points in public interest regulation of telecommunications, what would be elements of that platform?
A key element would be employment. There's got to be employment at reasonable levels in the industry to deliver adequate levels of service. The interest of consumers and the interest of employees run parallel. And this has to be, I think, almost the sine qua non, the elemental criterion for any restructuring along public interest lines. What do I mean? Well, you just try getting somebody live to talk to on a telecommunications network. It may be a little harder on the wireless end, on the cell phone end, than on the wireline end. But you try to get a live operator, and you get some idea of the problems that are involved. They're cutting the ranks of their customer service people, cutting the ranks of their technicians, as cost-cutting measures because of the huge crisis that's been roiling the industry for the last 3 years or so as a result of the duplication and overinvestment that competition brought in over the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
So going forward, we need to have more employment and more stable employment, high-skill, high-wage employment, so as to deliver levels of service that are in the public interest. That's the core of it.
Okay.
Beyond that, one can go in a lot of other directions. What about information services? Some of us are of an age to be able to remember when information was a free service. Why not expand the information services that the telephone network makes possible so it's not just telephone numbers but other things that you might be able to get on a free basis? Is it so intolerable to imagine that, for example, like public broadcasting, we could deliver certain kinds of information resources in a relatively quote-unquote free way?
Like what sort of stuff?
Well, what would you like?
Well, you tell me. I don't even know. It's so abstract right now. I don't even know what's
well,
on the table.
I mean, it used to be, again, going back when they were just introducing these ideas, that there'd be relatively trivial services, like you could call up and get the time for free, call up and get, a little weather report for free. You could do these things, but then, of course, the Weather Channel would be climbing down your neck for today as competing with the private sector or competing with another business interest, and they can't match free. But there's a whole range of other things. What about community events that are going on in the local area? What about, any kind of emergency service if there's something that needs to be brought out for a particular neighborhood, a power lines down in a winter storm? You could use a telephone network for things like this. Instead of having everybody be glued to the television set where they, by the way, also get to watch ads.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole range of community information services that could be invented around the telephone system and piggybacked on it. It's an incredible resource for spreading information for free.
Why
not treat it that way and make it possible for us to develop it in that fashion?
Okay, so you got a couple things. Is there anything else on the your short list?
Honestly speaking, this is an area where we all have to work on it together. This is where a reform entity, a reform movement should be putting its thought.
Now, this year we've had a huge fight over, and we're still in the middle of it, over rules regulating the ownership of broadcast media in the United States. And telecommunication companies haven't really been a factor in these debates currently. But what is the linkage between the issues we've been talking about with telephone regulation and ownership and broadcast ownership and media ownership in general?
Well, there's two levels of linkage that I can immediately mention. One, the telecommunications infrastructure is the distribution system for broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the terms on which broadcasters have access to it have a lot to do with what they can deliver.
Okay.
The other is, and it's a related thing, the convergence, so-called. In the near future, the telecommunications system is going to be delivering more and more of the media signals in a common digital bitstream.
You know, Dan Schiller, I think we could go on and on right there. That's a whole show. Unfortunately, I see that our time is drawn to an end. I'd like to thank Dan Schiller for being my guest today on Media Matters. I'll be back 1 week from today with another guest. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thanks, Bob.
I'm Ira Glass. Every year near Thanksgiving, This American Life brings you our annual program about poultry.
You ready for the bird?
Chickens, ducks, turkeys.
That's the day we had before the night 3,000 turkeys died.
Real and fictional.
Chicken!
He's everywhere! He's everywhere!
Today, the tradition continues.
Why would you do that?
Today at 6 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny and breezy with the high in the mid-50s. Southwest winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, turning west late. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low around 30 degrees and northwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the lower 40s and northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Currently 53 degrees outside our studios. A Prairie Home Companion is next. It's 2 p.m.